We like big things. We like big. There's just something about big that attracts us. Big is powerful. Big is more important. It's more exciting. It's more fun. What's the longest line at Six Flags Great America? Anybody been there this summer? What's the longest line there? It's for the Raging Bull. Do you know why it's so long? Because the Raging Bull is the biggest roller coaster in the park. It's the biggest, it's the highest, it's the fastest. There are other roller coasters, certainly, but people want the big one. And so they're willing to wait in line longer just to ride that. Everybody knows what New York City is. It's the biggest city in America. What do they call New York City? Big Apple. You probably don't know much about Manawi, Nebraska, do you? You know what the population of Manawi, Nebraska is? One. Just one. 84-year-old Elsie Eisner is the only citizen of Manawi, Nebraska. She's the mayor. She's the bartender. She's the librarian. She pays taxes to herself. We don't know much about that. Now, well, you know a little bit of something now, don't you? Ever been at a birthday party and they're passing out cake, and you know you want that biggest piece of cake that's going to somebody else, and you got that little feeling in your heart, that little feeling of jealousy because you want that piece of cake. And we do the same thing when we go shopping and we see those big bins of watermelons, and you see that there's some on top, but you see just maybe a little bit further down there's a bigger one, just a little bit bigger. And so what do? You dig through it, don't you, to get to that bigger one. And you have no guarantees that one that's just a little bit bigger is going to be any better than the one that was on top. But you want the big one, don't you? Truck commercials, they're all bragging that they have the biggest engine in their class. Ooh, I like the sound of that. Big engine. I don't know why I like the sound of it. It's going to take up much more gas and cost more to drive, but I like the sound of a big engine. And so they push that idea on us. Up in the north and the northwest, there's a mysterious, this mythical creature walking around who has large feet. We all know what his name is, right?
Sasquatch.
Sasquatch, yeah. We know him better as what? Bigfoot. We don't know anything else about him except that he's got big feet. So that's what we're going to call him, big feet. And people are obsessed with him, with knowing if he's really out there. If you're anything like me, you will drive out of your way a couple blocks to avoid a pothole in your neighborhood. You don't want to go near that pothole at all. And yet, how many people have driven 24 hours to get out to the Grand Canyon? It's just a big hole in the ground. It's no different than the pothole. They're just holes in the ground. But what's the Grand Canyon compared to the pothole? It's bigger. It's big. We want to go see big. We want to be a part of big. We'll pay money to go see a Godzilla movie. I doubt anybody would pay money to go see a movie starring that little Geico rodent or lizard. You would? You, why? He's not big. And I might pay money to see Godzilla step on him, but that's just personal opinion. I was talking with some pastors at General Conference, and we were sitting around the table during one of our meals, and they were talking about their churches, and they were talking about the size of their churches and some of the things that they wanted to accomplish and some of the things that they hoped to accomplish and some of the things that they couldn't accomplish. And it all seemed to come back to the same idea. They were too small to do some of the things that they wanted to do. They were too small. At least they thought so. That was their thinking. They thought they were too small, and they were missing something that's extremely important. They're missing something extremely important. In their pursuit of success, in whatever way they define success, they miss the point that God does some of his biggest things with some of the smallest things. God does some of his biggest things with some of the smallest things. He does amazing things with little things. Yes, We serve a God of big, big things. But we also serve a God of small things. When we surrender to His will, He is able to take the littlest things and turn them into mighty works for His glory. We're going to be taking a look at the book of Judges this morning, chapter 6 and chapter 7. And before we get there, I want to give you a little bit of background about what's going on in the book of Judges. The book of Judges takes place after the time of Moses and after the time of Joshua, after Moses had led the people out of Egypt through the wilderness. They settled into the promised land. Joshua carried them, led them into the promised land. They settled there. And so this is a time after that. They were 12 autonomous tribes. They operated under their own leadership. They had no central government. But they did have a central problem. Their central problem was this. They would worship God. They would slowly fall away, commit apostasy, which was worshiping other gods and idols. And God would punish them, usually through other nations, through other peoples. He would bring hardship upon them. And then they would cry out to God, begging for mercy. And God would send them someone called a judge, an ad hoc leader to help to lead the people out of the particular situation that they were in. And that's what we're getting to when we get to Judges chapter 6. And I want to read the first six verses to you. We're going to be spending time in chapter 6 and 7 this morning. And chapter 6, verse 1 says this, "Again the Israelites did evil in the eyes of the Lord, and for 7 years He gave them into the hands of the Midianites." This is nothing new. This is a pattern. This is a cyclical pattern that we find with the Israelites. And this pattern carries through the entire Old Testament from the time that they are brought out of Egypt until the time of Christ. They would worship false gods. Then they would face hardship. And then God would rescue them when they called out to Him. "Because the power of Midian was so oppressive, the Israelites prepared shelters for themselves in mountain clefts, caves, and strongholds. Whenever the Israelites planted their crops, the Midianites, the Amalekites, and other eastern people invaded the country. They camped on the land and ruined the crops all the way to Gaza and did not spare a living thing for Israel, neither sheep nor cattle nor donkey. They came up with their livestock and their tents like swarms of locusts. It was impossible to count the men and their camels. They invaded the land to ravage it. Midian so impoverished the Israelites that they cried out to the Lord for help." And this is a perfect example. These few verses summarize perfectly the situation of the Israelites and what they would go through over and over and over again. So the scene is this. The Israelites begin worshiping other gods. God sends the Midianites to oppress them. The Israelites call out to God and say, "Save us." And God sends them a judge, a leader, to lead them out of this situation. And this is where we are introduced to somebody named Gideon. And we are introduced to Gideon later on, right after these verses, verses 7 through 39. And there's a lot of material there. We're not going to go through all of it, but just know that we are introduced to this character named Gideon. And he's the youngest son in an obscure family in one of the smallest of the 12 tribes. He was a nobody. And he said that to God when God called him, "Hey, I'm nobody." And it's not that he doubted God. He understood his standing. He understood his lot in life. He looked at his circumstances and said, I can't lead an army. I can't lead a people out of oppression. He didn't think he had the qualifications of a great military leader. He thought he was unworthy. But God thought Gideon was better than his circumstances. God thought Gideon was better than his situation. God saw Gideon differently than Gideon saw himself through various events in chapter 6. Gideon's faith grows. He becomes closer to God. He begins to understand God a little bit better, and his faith grows. It's interesting how those who feel unworthy are often the ones that God calls. We see this with Moses. We see this with others. They think they don't have what it takes to be the leader that God wants them to be. And so they rule themselves out, forgetting the power of God to move and work in their lives. We see it in Moses. We see it in Jeremiah. And sometimes they just need a little bit of prodding. They just need God to prod them just a little bit, as God did with Moses and God does with Gideon. Go back and read the rest of chapter 6 when you get home. So Gideon sends out a call. He accepts the responsibility given to him, and he sends out a call for soldiers. And it's amazing. People responded to his call. Apparently, they were tired of the oppression. And so when we get up to chapter 7, we see this. Early in the morning, Jerubbaal, that is Gideon, and all his men camped at the spring of Herod. The camp of Midian was north of them in the valley area near the hill of Moreh. The Lord said to Gideon, "You have too many men for me to deliver Midian into their hands. In order that the Israelites may not boast against me that her own strength has saved her, announce now to the people, anyone who trembles with fear may turn back and leave Mount Gilead." So 22,000 men left, while 10,000 remained. Gideon had to be feeling pretty good there at the beginning. He sends out his battle cry. He's not a soldier. He's not a warrior. He's not a great military leader, but he sends out this call, a call to arms. And people come. 32,000 soldiers come. And Gideon had to be feeling pretty good there for a while. And so Gideon makes camp with his men at the spring of Herod. And that's a good place to camp out because it's a large pool of water. If he's going to battle, Gideon has control of the water supply here. It's a great place to be. A large pool, a fresh stream that runs through it. This is excellent. But there's something ironic about the name Herod. It means fear and trembling. That's what this little spring was called, a spring of fear and trembling. Now, we don't know exactly why, but that's what Herod means. And so God sees 32,000 men. He says, yeah, that's too many to fight this war. Now, I don't know about you guys, but if I'm in the military, one of the things I think is that you can never have too many people to win a war. But I'm not a military leader, and I'm not God. I don't do things the way God does all the time. I don't think the way God does all the time. I try, but the way God thinks is so much different than the way we humans often think. And God's looking at this army that Gideon has, these soldiers ready and willing to fight, 32,000 of them, and he says, that's too many to win this war. If you go with 32,000 men to fight this war and you win, they are going to take the credit for the victory instead of giving the credit to me. And so God tells Gideon, send those home. Send those home. Verse 3, announce now to the people, anyone who trembles with fear. What was the name of that spring again? Fear and trembling? Anyone who trembles with fear may turn back and leave Mount Gilead. So, 22,000 men turn around and go home. That's the end of that. Well, Gideon still has 10,000 men, right? He still has 10,000 men. That's a good number. That's a good number. He could still go to war with 10,000 men. These 22,000 went home. But yeah, this is an interesting thing. What was home to them? Well, remember where they're living? They're living in caves. They're hiding out in caves in the clefts of mountains. And these oppressors are coming in and stealing their crops, and they're stealing their livestock, and they're destroying everything. And rather than fight for their freedom, these 22,000 men, rather than trust in God, these 22,000 men wanted to go home to that. They felt that that life of oppression was better than the risk that came with fighting for God. Let's look at verse 4. But the Lord said to Gideon, there are still too many men. 10,000, there's still too many men. Gideon's down to one third of his original army. There's still too many of them, God says. Take them down to the water, and I will sift them for you there. If I say this one shall go with you, he shall go. But if I say this one shall not go with you, he shall not go. So Gideon took the men down to the water. There the Lord said to him, separate those who lap the water with their tongues like a dog from those who kneel down to drink. 300 men lapped with their hands to their mouths. All the rest got down on their knees to drink. That's an interesting way of choosing who would go and who would stay. God knew what he was doing. But for some reason, only 300 people drank the way that God wanted them to drink. Only drank the water the way that God wanted to, by cupping their hands and lifting it to their mouth as opposed to getting on their hands and knees and putting their face in the water. And God said the 300 of those men who cupped their hands and brought the water to their mouth, those are the ones that we're going to keep. Those are the one. Verse 7, the Lord said to Gideon, with the 300 men that lapped, I will save you and give the Midianites into your hands. Let all the other men go, each to his own place. So Gideon sent the rest of the Israelites to their tents, but kept the 300, who took over the provisions and trumpets of the others. This is 1%. 1% of his original army size. 1%. Drop down to verse 12. It says, the Midianites, the Amalekites, and all the other eastern people had settled in the valley thick as locusts. Their camels could no more be counted than the sands on the seashore. That is what 300 men are going to go up against. Sounds like a scary proposition to me. It sounds scary. But Gideon and these men were committed to following the Lord and committed to his plan. And God separates them out and leaves 300. They take the provision, the provisions of the 9,700 that walked away, and 300 men are left. And this is when God says, now we can get down to business. Now there's 1% of the original army size against this vast army that is so large we can't even count. You can't even count them. There's so many of them. You can't count their camels. There's too many to count. This is a battle. Not in my eyes. This is frightening. This is frightening. But we don't do things the way God does all the time, do we? We don't think like God does. He thinks greater than us, and he knows his power. Drop down to verse 16, where it says this. Dividing the 300 men into three companies, he placed trumpets and empty jars in the hands of all of them with torches inside. Watch me, he told them. Follow my lead. When I get to the edge of the camp, do exactly as I do. When I and all who are with me blow our trumpets, then from all around the camp, blow yours and shout, for the Lord and for Gideon. Gideon and the 100 men with him reached the edge of the camp at the beginning of the middle watch, just after they had changed the guard. This would be at nighttime. They blew their trumpets and broke the jars and that were in their hands. The three companies blew the trumpets and smashed the jars, grasping the torches in their left hands and holding in their right hands the trumpets, which were to trumpets they were to blow. They shouted, "A sword for the Lord and for Gideon!" While each man held his position around the camp, all the Midianites ran, crying out as they fled. When the 300 men sounded, the Lord caused the men throughout the camp to turn on each other with their swords. How do you win a battle so large with only 300 people? You don't. You don't. God does. That's who wins those kinds of battles. Not you and I. But God. 300 men were tired of the status quo. They were tired of what had been going on in their nation. So they took the provisions of the other men. They took the provisions of the other men who had left. They were prepared. They were equipped. Gideon laid out a strategy. He said, this is the way we are going to do it. We're going to use the provisions that we have, and we're going to do it in this very strategic manner. Then he took action. He marched forward. He went forward, ready to do as God said, ready to fight. And then he let God do the rest. And God did. God did do the rest. God won a major victory for his people with only 300 soldiers. He did something big with something very small. The odds were 100 to 1 if we started out with Gideon's original army, 3,200. If the enemy had 3,200, the odds are 100 to 1. But it seems that they had even more than that. So we don't know what the odds were, but it was hugely in favor of the Midianites. God's modus operandi, the way he operates, is so much different than the way we operate. We see big, and we think that's the best there is. We see big, and we say, that's what I want. I want that bigger engine in my truck. I want that bigger watermelon. I want to ride that bigger, faster ride, because I think those things are going to be better for me. And I don't know where we get that mentality, but I don't think it comes from God, because God does some of his biggest things with some of the smallest things. God still has a plan. He still uses small things in big ways to accomplish his plan. He still uses small things in big ways to accomplish his plan. He still uses small groups to win big victories. He uses small churches, just like ours, to win big victories for his kingdom. He wants to use our church. He wants to use our church right here, right now, in big ways to accomplish his plan. Here's some important things I think that we learned from Gideon. Some important things I think we learned from this story of the 300 going up against the large Midianite army. I think one of the first things we learn is that God sees us differently than we see ourselves. Gideon saw himself one way, God saw him another way. Gideon dismissed himself because of his circumstances and his situation. God said, no, you are the one I want to accomplish this big task. God sees us differently than we see ourselves. I think the second thing we need to learn from this story is that we need to be open. We need to be open to new ideas. We need to be open to things that seem impossible on our own. We need to be open to the prospect that God may use things that we have, people that we have, in ways that we have not seen before, in ways that we have not used before. We may talk about ideas that are out of the ordinary. We may talk about things that don't seem possible on our own. But if it's God's will and he's directing us, you can be sure we will accomplish it. The third thing we learn is that we need to be prepared. We need to be prepared. What did the 300 men do when the 9,700 walked off? They took their provisions. They made sure they were prepared before they went into battle. God was going to win the victory. They still needed to be prepared. I think we need to take a close look at the provisions that we have, the gifts and abilities that we have, the building that we have, the community that we are a part of. And look at ways that we can use those things, the right provisions, the right people, to accomplish big things for God. The fourth thing we learned is to trust God, but plan strategically. Trust God, but plan strategically. Gideon and his army didn't march off with their hands in their pockets. They mapped out a plan. They had a strategy for victory. And it was an excellent strategy because it certainly fooled the Midianites. They mapped out their strategy, decided what they were going to do, and then they showed up. They showed up, they marched forward expecting God to do something big, something bigger than what they were. We need to be a part of this congregation. You need to be a part of this congregation. You need to be willing. You need to be ready to fulfill your role, to fulfill your role and trust that God will fulfill His. You need to be ready to move forward. And finally, you need to expect things from God for our small group. You need to expect big things from God from our small group. Do we want big things for God? I think we do. Do we want big things for our church? I think we do. Then we need to expect them. Because God will deliver. He still has a plan. It's time for us to shake up our status quo. It's time for us to shout, "For the Lord! For the Lord!" and move forward. We may be small, but God does some of His biggest things with small things. We may be small, but we serve a big, big God. And we need to prepare ourselves to be used by Him in a big way. I think we're ready for that. I think as a church we are ready for on board because I think we have a God who is preparing to use us in this community in big ways.